And next on Radio 4, the Million Pound Radio Show World Cup Special, a show devoted almost entirely to the sport of football. For anyone listening from Scotland, football is a game played with a spherical ball between two teams of 11 players who attempt to throw the ball into the opposition's goal. Players may use their feet only. The only players permitted to use their hands are the goalkeepers and Diego Maradona. For any Scottish goalkeeper, hands are the bits at the end of each goal with a five pointy bit.
It's time for the Million Pound Radio Show, and here are your hosts, Andy Hamilton and Nick Revel.
Thank you very much. Good evening. Welcome to the show. Later on, we'll be revealing how Colin Moynihan is in favour of all-seater stadiums, because otherwise he can't see anything.
The short-ass git.
Satire. And we'll be visiting the FA School of Excellence, which takes young footballers full of skill, flair and imagination and turns them into England players.
I tell you though, Andy, he really should have played Brian Robson against Egypt. You know?
I was injured, Nick. I mean, Achilles tendons take a long time to get better. I know, I've had one myself.
Yeah, true. And look how long it's kept you out of the England team, eh?
Yeah. Well, exactly. I mean, and they need me right now, let's face it.
Yeah. Hang on. You're serious, aren't you?
Well, of course I am. I mean, what England need in midfield is my kind of mature footballing brain.
Andy, I've seen you play. You're fat. You're slow, you never run. You're the only footballer I've ever seen with birds perched on him. And you seriously think you could play for England in midfield?
Nah, I suppose you're right.
The back four, yes, obviously. Like Terry Butcher, but midfield? Come on, now, I could play in midfield.
No, listen, Nick, I don't need to move around. My game's based on skill, vision, science, you know, unlike yours.
And what does that mean?
Well, your idea of football is pretty crude, isn't it, I mean? There can't be many people who regard Wimbledon style as too puffy.
Football's a man's game, Andy. You've got to boot the ball and get stuck in.
Yeah, well, you certainly got stuck in that game the other week, didn't you, against that little winger? You tripped him up, stamped on him, bit him, then when he got up, you headbutted him.
At any level, you have to compete physically.
Nick, it was a charity match against the blind school. It's embarrassing. I mean, fancy wanting to muffle the ball with sacking so they wouldn't hear it.
We won, though, didn't we?
Yeah. Stuff the beggars. Okay, right. Well, of course, listeners, no World Cup programme would be complete without its panel of experts, and our panel consists of Emlyn Hughes.
He must play ball.
Jeff Hurst.
Good evening.
And George Best, who hasn't turned up. However, in his place, George has kindly sent along one of his girlfriends, former Miss Sweden, Ava Svenstrom. Welcome, Ava.
Good evening. I'm Swedish. From Sweden.
Right. Yeah. Now, Emily, you never actually played in the final stages of a World Cup, did you?
Well, as I was telling me old mucker Princess Anne, I was in the England squad that went to Mexico in 1970.
Yes, I heard you were primarily selected because you were the only player who could sing the high bits in the team's World Cup singing.
Yeah, that's right. Alan Ball got laryngitis. Right. But, you know, Elton, it's a funny thing, but in all the years I was a regular in the England defence, we never once qualified for the World Cup.
Yes, funny that. Mm. Turning to you, Jeff Hurst, now, of course, you experienced World Cup glory, that memorable day in 66 when you became the only player ever to hit a hat-trick in a World Cup final.
That's right, yeah. Great day.
Yeah. Although, of course, the more one looks at reruns, Jeff, the more one has to say that second goal of yours looks as if it didn't actually cross the line.
Well, maybe so.
Now, which means that, strictly speaking, you didn't actually score a hat-trick.
Well, it's not important. I mean, even not counting that goal, we still won 3-2, and I got two.
Absolutely. Point taken, Jeff. No, you're quite right. And that last goal, you really smashed that one home. Great shot.
Oh, thanks.
Even if there were spectators on the pitch.
Sorry?
Well, you remember, Jeff. Some people are on the pitch. They think it's all over. It is now. I mean, technically, the ref should have stopped the game well before you hit that shot, shouldn't he? So that's two goals that you shouldn't have been given.
Well, That still leaves that pretty good header.
That pretty good, suspiciously offside-looking header.
Oh, come on, I mean, the linesman would have flagged.
What was his eyesight, Jeff? That Russian linesman, he's the one who gave you the other goal, the one that was over the line. Now, I'm sorry, Jeff, but objectively, whichever way you look at it, right, none of those goals should have stood. So, strictly speaking, you didn't score any goals in the 66 final, and England lost 2-1.
No goals at all?
Nope. Had a bit of a stinker, really, didn't you? How does it feel to let your country down like that, Jeff?
Well, I must protest here, Elton, because in 66, Jeff Hurst played brilliantly.
Lee.
And in 1970, Jeff Hurst played brilliantly.
Lee.
No, Lee was disappointing in 1970. In fact, I think a lot of the players would admit they could have done a bit mucher.
More.
And Amore did play brilliant. But generally, they should have played weller.
You mean better?
No, weller. Keith Weller. Mm. As a right-sided midfield.
Yes, all right,
no, in fact, I'd have given Bully a run in 1970.
Shut up, yes. Sit down over there, burn your jumper or something. Okay. Now, let's turn to Miss Sweden, shall we? Now, Ava, did your time with George Best give you an appreciation of his marvellous skill?
Oh, yes, indeed. Many of the time he would show me how he could curl one in from 25 yards.
Yes, I bet he did. Now, tell me, everyone back in Sweden must have been very disappointed when Sweden went out.
Oh, yes. There was a huge show of national emotion.
Mm, what form did that take?
Oh, people sitting around in armchairs saying, oh, well, there you go. Well,
right. They were as upset as that then, were they? Right. Well, right now we've got a £1 million radio show exclusive. We've actually got a secret recording of Bobby Robson's pre-match team talk before the Egypt game.
Okay, lads, okay, come on, round. Come round. Pay attention now. Everyone feeling okay?
Yeah.
Gary, how's the talk?
Oh, never better, boss. Fit and raring to go.
Great.
Thanks to Olga.
Olga?
Brian Saitheeler. She's worked wonders.
Secured my Bruce Instead in 10 minutes.
Bruce Instead, Steve? When did this happen?
Well, when Mark Wright dropped his crystal ball on my foot, you know.
Well, I were just gazing at the future, checking out on what kind of forward runs El Cas will be making.
El Cas? Mark, you're marking Hassan.
No need.
What do you mean, no need? He's fast, he's strong.
He's a Virgo.
Hey!
What's this? We checked his star charts.
His moon's in the wrong house. He'll do nothing.
Nothing at all.
Now, look here, lads. Now, look, Barnsley, lad. What's wrong with Barnsley? He looks like he's in a trance.
Oh, he's in a trance, boss.
Well, get him out of this.
Not a good idea, boss. I'm using regressive hypnotherapy. At the moment, he thinks he's 6 years old.
Oh, God, well, try and make him think he's a dangerous goal-scoring Liverpool striker. God knows I tried hard enough. Now, Schultz,
where's my goalkeeper? Where is he?
Gaza, do you know where he is?
Right, why, he's in the emergency therapy tank.
Don't tell me that Peter Shilton's into this mumbo-jumbo stuff as well.
No, I shot him in there for the laugh. I'm the gutter in the team.
Shut up, Gaza. Let's talk about football here. Let's think about the game.
Okay.
About Egypt, about goals, getting away from markers.
No problem, boss. They won't see me.
Ah, that's more like it, Gary, lad. They won't see you, lad. No, they won't. Not for your pace, eh?
No, boss. They won't see me because Olga gave me this potion to make me disappear during the game.
Oh, my God. Get me on a flight to Eindhoven.
I tell you what, Nick, that potion worked really well, didn't it?
Yeah, but why did Chris Waddle drink so much of it?
Emily, I know you've got strong views on England's tactical formation. Now, what changes would you make?
I'd be positive. I'm talking attack. I'm talking bull.
Yes, I know, but what changes? Hang on, Emily. If I can just interrupt you there mercifully. I hear we've got Jackie Charlton, direct on the line from Italy, with some sensational news. Jack, I understand you're sending Ray Houghton home. Is that right?
Ah, that's right.
It's a disciplinary offence.
Ah, very serious disciplinary offence indeed. I caught him passing the ball along the ground. Quite unforgivable. He'll be on the first plane home.
Yeah. Now, when did he do this? During the Holland game?
No, it was during a training session, but you got to nip this sort of thing in the bud, you know. Otherwise, it'll spread like wildfire.
Cheers, Jack. Thanks for talking to us. Good luck. And now.
Excuse me, signore. Do you work for the Sun newspaper?
No.
Well, I'm a Sardinian, and I shall not report the vilified of my sister. It was only to my family by saying she messed around with some English footballers, and now I look for him.
Well, look, I appreciate that you feel the son treated your sister badly, but I really don't think you should take the law into your own hands. I mean, look, why don't you take your case to that TV program, Hard News, with Raymond Snoddy?
I don't need the Raymondo Snoddy. I have a hunting rifle. This reporter must die. To dishonor us by saying my sister slept with a footballer is despicable. But to dishonor her by saying she slept with an English footballer is unforgivable. We must pay.
Hang on, just a second. Are you seriously saying you're actually going to hunt down and murder this Sun reporter in cold blood?
Si.
You'll find him at Wapping. Here's the address.
With all your cabs, don't see you get every quicker. Ciao. Nice man. Wouldn't mind watching that. Right. Well, with me now, I have Jim Layton, who had such a tragic evening. Please, Tyler. Such a tragic evening in goal against the Brazilians. Now, Jim, everyone in Scotland's terribly disappointed. You must be choked.
Well, I do feel a bit down.
No, that's what they're saying back in Scotland. You must be choked. All the Rossies, they're not sure which, you know. They're going to hold a national referendum, apparently.
Oh, right. Great.
Jim, you had a great match, but you made one tiny little mistake. Now, why are Scottish goalkeepers so incredibly unlucky?
Well, that's a good question, Andy. I don't...
Well, Jim Layton there, crushed by a falling hippo. I just wonder what the odds were against that. Such an unlucky man.
Later on in the show, we'll be asking why is it that so many of the England squad play like their names. Steve Bull plays like a bull, Terry Butcher plays like a butcher, and I feel really sorry for David Seaman.
Well, of course, one sad and recurring theme of this World Cup has been the grim spectre of hooliganism. Now, Dr. Janet Stevens, you've just written a book analysing the causes of football hooliganism. What are your findings?
Well, there are several factors that have to be taken into account, Andy.
Mm-hmm.
Firstly, there's the acute tribal bonding that often unites young males in shows of assertive macho aggression designed to enhance their standing as warriors in the eyes of their peers.
Right, really.
Then there's the socio-psychological damage that many of the hooligans have experienced, which leaves them with a feeling that in some way society has abandoned them.
Mm.
But finally, of course, there is one crucial, overriding social catalyst which prompts these young men to engage in cathartic displays of primal, ritualistic violence.
What's that?
The fist.
The fist?
Yes, and it's fist out of their heads, completely out of their trees, and they don't know what they're doing.
Right, but what about these other factors, the tribal male bonding and these socio-psychological causes?
Not as influential as the lager, thank you.
Right, okay. Thank you, Desmond Morris. Now, you've written about soccer hooliganism.
Yes, that's right. I've observed clear parallels between the behaviour of hooligans and that of various kinds of apes. And these forms of behaviour are governed by the urge to assert dominance over the pack, the urge to protect territory.
Basic animal urges.
That's right. Mm. But there's one profound biological reason why these hooligans behave the way they do, and that is that they're morons.
Morons.
Yes, monumentally stupid. Intellectually, no higher than a brain-damaged amoeba.
But how do you account for the fact that so much of the violence occurs well away from the ground?
Well, obviously it's very difficult to find your way to a football ground when you're that stupid.
Mm.
Quite. I mean, for most of them, interpreting a road sign is an impossible dream. So they wander around, totally lost, trying to work out what comes after, here we go. They fail, get frustrated, spot their reflections in a shop window, accuse their reflections of staring at them, attack their reflections, smashing the shop window and waking up in a pool of blood.
Mm, thank you, Desmond. So, what is the answer? Dave, you're a pissed moron. Why do you engage?
Get him! Bash him! Get him out!
Yes, it's all right, Mr. Moynihan. We'll get to you. You'll get your turn in a minute. Just take it easy. Go and sit down over there, all right? Yeah, in the ashtray, yeah. That's it. Now, Dave, why do you engage in these mindless acts of violence?
Well, Andy, you know, us hooligans, we realise that hooliganism damages England's reputation in the world, you know, but we also realise it would be damaged even more if our club sides were allowed back into Europe to play and the rest of the world saw how useless they are.
All right, yeah, yeah. Totally logical, really. Now... Yeah. Dr. Stevens, any other root causes of hooliganism?
Well, yes, a lot of it dates from childhood, when they pick up values from their parents. For instance, this is a playground conversation I recorded the other day. What's an expert?
You know, those men who sit around and tell you which team's going to win and then the other team wins.
Oh, yeah, I know. You know the one with the big chin?
Jimmy Hill?
Mm, yeah. He used to work on a ship.
Eh?
He used to be an anchor. And every time he says something, my dad says, "Jimmy, you're you anchor."
I think a lot of the England players must have worked on ships then. Butcher, you anchor.
Waddle, you anchor.
Which one's Waddle?
One with a stupid haircut. It looks like someone's standing behind him.
I thought his name was Head. Dickhead.
No. Referee's called Dickhead.
No, no. The referee is called Jesus. Jesus, referee.
Let's play the game.
Okay, let's play Journalists and Bobby Robson.
Okay, I'll be Bobby Robson. You get the stones.
Okay.
Well, there you have it. Evidence that children are learning to stone England managers at the age of six. That's good to see. Now, on the line now, I have Mick McCarthy, one of the players in the Irish squad. Thanks for talking to us, Mick.
My pleasure.
Now, Mick, you were born in Barnsley, and you're obviously one of the many players in the Irish squad who isn't Irish by birth. How do you respond to charges that it's a bit absurd the way players can choose to play for Ireland?
No, no way. I'm totally committed to Ireland now. We all are. We die for Ireland, I tell you. And when we pull on that red shirt...
Green shirt.
When I pull on that green shirt, you know, you can be sure I'll be giving 100% and trying to give them something to cheer about in the bars of Llandudno.
That's Wales.
Yeah.
And your adopted country is obviously Ireland.
Oh, yeah, no, of course. What I meant was, you know, to give them something to cheer about in the bars of old Belfast.
Which is Northern Ireland. You play for Southern Ireland.
Well, is there a difference between them, then?
They've been having a bit of a difference for some time. It's been in some of the papers still. OK, well, thanks, Mick, and good luck.
Well, yucky down, as we Irish say.
Yeah. Yep. Later, I'll be talking to Jackie Charlton about his contention that Diego Maradona is descended from the O'Maradona family of County Kildare. But turning away from the World Cup for a moment to look at a less important topic, mad cow disease, could it prove fatal to humans? With us in the studio now is the Minister for Agriculture, John Gummer. Now, Mr. Gummer, there are fears that BSE, which causes the brain to turn sponge-like and develop holes, may already have infected humans via the food chain. And that this
now, let's get one thing straight. On the advice of the finest scientists, I can reassure everybody that British beef is safe and that there is absolutely no question of people having caught BSE.
So you're saying that there are no human beings wandering around with holes in their brains?
That's correct.
Have you met him in Hughes?
Hiya, Johnny Pal!
Well, obviously one can't be 100% sure. Huh?
He must pick bull.
In fact, I think I'll get the scientists to look at it again. But as far as we can reasonably ascertain, we know it's not a threat.
Right, now I understand that BSE arose in cattle after they were fed the carcasses of scrapie-infected sheep.
That's correct.
Mm. Not something cows are renowned for, is it, eating sheep? I mean, you don't often see packs of predatory freezing. You know, stalking sheep through the long grass and then leaping out with a blood-curdling moo onto some straggling lamb and then chewing it slowly to death over a period of months.
Well, no, admittedly, sheep meat is not naturally part of their bovine diet, but we decided to start up this practice for a variety of complex reasons, the most compelling being...
It was sheep.
That's correct.
Now, so, what exactly causes BSE? Is it a virus, an agent?
We don't know.
And how is it transmitted?
We don't know.
Can it be passed on genetically?
We don't know.
And how can it be detected?
Now, we do know that. Basically, you can detect BSE as soon as cow falls over and dies.
Right. So, the position is, you don't know what it is, where it comes from, how it got there, or how to find it once it gets there, but the one thing you do know is, it's not a risk.
Yes, that's it, in a nutshell.
Pretty enormous bloody nutshell, but never mind. Thank you, Mr. Gummer. Of course, in an effort to convince us that beef was safe, Mr. Gummer was photographed feeding a beef burger to his younger daughter. So I suppose doctors will be on the lookout for signs that her brain is turning spongy, though as she's Mr. Gummer's child, it may, of course, be hard to tell. And now, Emlyn, do you eat beef?
Oh, yes, Desmond. I eat nothing but beef. And look what it's done to me.
Yes. Well, as the whole country's out to turn vegetarian, let's turn to Nick. Now, are you enjoying the World Cup, Nick?
Oh, yeah, I'm having a fabulous time. I really love it. Mm. Muriel's not, though. Mm-hmm. She got really annoyed with me, you know, just because I bought one of those miniature portable TVs.
Oh, well, they are quite expensive.
No, it wasn't the money. She got uptight just because I took it with me when I went to see her, you know, when she was in hospital.
What for?
Well, Cameroon versus Argentina. I didn't want to miss the opening game.
No, I meant, why was Muriel in hospital?
Oh, not sure.
When did she get out of hospital?
Must have been the Wednesday, yeah, because it was Uruguay versus Spain, of course, yeah. She was in a foul mood as well. Forgot her keys, was waiting on the step for half an hour.
Oh, you mean you were actually out while one of the games was on?
No, but I didn't answer the door till half time, did I? She really got the hump.
Oh, how unreasonable.
Well, some people just have no consideration, Andy.
Yeah, you're not kidding.
Oh, that was it.
What?
Why, she was in hospital. I remember now. She had a kid.
She had a baby. Boy or girl?
She did tell me. She didn't stay long. She just kicked in the TV and went off to stay at Isabel and Brendan's.
That's terrible.
Well, it would have been, you know. It's like just lucky I bought that other TV. Oh.
Yes, the unmistakable sound of Pavarotti singing Nessun Dorma. It's spectacular, it's exciting, and Puccini's dead, so it's out of copyright. And for millions, it encapsulates the drama of soccer, the glory that is football.
In 1431 AD, Portuguese travellers reported seeing a game in Afghanistan where tribesmen kicked the dismembered torso of an enemy around a field, thus giving rise to the expression, a game of two halves. And in the 1600s, English peasants would kick a pig's bladder from village to village.
Hard work, this, ain't it, Theo?
Oh, bloody hard.
Oh, perhaps if we took the bladder out of the pig.
It was in the late 1800s that many English soccer clubs were established. Woolwich Arsenal began by playing on Woolwich Fields, where they became known as the Gunners, before they changed their name to just Arsenal and moved to Highbury, where they became known as the Boring Gits.
The game was now spreading across the world. In the famous Christmas Day football match during the First World War, British and German soldiers met in no man's land, engaged in a sporting game of football, swapped shirts, and were shot dead by their own side as they returned to the trenches. After the war, football continued to grow in the 20s and 30s. Nobby Oldroyd, who played centre-forward for Burnley and Accrington Stanley, remembers.
Ah, well, in them days, you see, football were a man's game. The ball were much heavier for a start-off. In fact, it were actually a boulder encased in leather. And every time you headed it, bits of brain would come flying out your lug-hole. But we didn't care. We were tough. We were faster, too, players in them days. Well, you only have to look at the newsreels, don't you? We used to bomb around that pitch with jerky little runs, and camera couldn't keep up with us half the time.
After the war, international football resumed. In the World Cup final of 1950, a staggering 192,000 Brazilians watched Brazil take on Uruguay in the Maracanã Stadium. The game was repeatedly stopped because the crowd kept blowing the ball into the Uruguay net.
The 60s was to prove a memorable decade for English football. The £100 a week maximum wage was abolished. Nowadays, the average First Division player earns up to £2,000 a week, or £350 if you're from the Inland Revenue. And of course, in 1966, millions watched as England took on West Germany in the World Cup final at Wembley. Before the game, Her Majesty the Queen met the teams and officials.
And this is Franz Beckenbauer, Your Majesty.
Hello.
Good to talk.
And this is one of the linesmen, Mr. Bakunov.
Oh, you're from Russia.
That is correct, Your Majesty.
Of course, you suffered terribly during the war in Russia.
Indeed, Your Majesty.
At the hands of the Germans.
Yes, Your Majesty.
Quite possibly, the fathers of these chaps trained today.
Well, possibly, Your Majesty, but
somehow, I can picture Mr. Beckenbauer's father sinking your homeland in blood and raping your sister. Can't you?
Well, Your Majesty,
anyway, I'll leave that thought with you.
And in the 9th minute of extra time, the Russian linesman awarded England the winning goal. Bobby Moore collected the cup, and then the gallant Germans collected their loser's medals from Her Majesty.
That one's for Coventry. That's for the Blitz.
And the 70s was to see the rise of the Dutch football team with their new system of total football, as opposed to the English system of total crap.
The 80s was to prove a difficult decade for football. The 86 World Cup was only a qualified success. The despotic regime in Mexico desperately attempted to project a sunny image, encouraging fans to take part in the Mexican wave by sequentially electrifying their seats.
And in the domestic game, the pressures to win were becoming intolerable, as was revealed in a recent TV documentary series which went behind the scenes at Sheffield United.
What's wrong with you lot? I can't f***ing believe it. You're playing like a bunch of f***ing sleepers. Okay. Now get your f***ing act together and f***ing, you know what I mean? Just f***ing those f***ers out there. Otherwise I'll f***ing, you know, sack the f***ing lot of you.
Okay, lads, so you heard what the club chaplain thinks.
And so, as English football faces the challenges of the 90s, some crucial questions arise. Can the blight of hooliganism be removed from our national game? Will our domestic team ever be admitted back into European competition? And perhaps most important of all, will Emlyn Hughes ever shut up?
He must be born!
And now a thought for those of you listening to this show on the Thursday repeat. If England lose against Belgium, at least Salman Rushdie will have company.
Now some late international news. The British government have agreed that they will accept an influx of 250,000 Hong Kong residents into Britain in 1999, and Jack Charlton's already claimed them as eligible to play for Ireland. Good night.
The Million Pound Radio Show was written and presented by Andy Hamilton and Nick Revel and featured Felicity Montague and Nigel Pegram. It was produced by Paul Mayhew Archer.